So this is a breakout session. It's about the Fairness for All strategy. You heard me talk last night. So this is more a chance to for you to ask questions. But I wanted to give some content so it's not aimless questions. If not that you're aimless people, but I thought that might be helpful. let's see. I have a couple slides which maybe I will show. One of them, I just wanted to just remind us all right at the beginning that Fairness for All is a political strategy. It's not a theology about what humans are or anything else. And in our lives, we believe in, you know, a truth, but we live our lives out in different arenas. And what we do in those different arenas, appropriately, is quite distinctive. So, if you think about somebody in your own family who came out to you as having conflicts about their gender identity, or in your extended family, they got into a same-sex relationship, there's something you would do about that, which would be very difficult. I don't know if it's more difficult than if they became Muslim. What would you do? Right? These are really hard things. But what you would do is probably different than what your church would do, right? If it's your niece who said, I am in a same-sex marriage and I want to bring my spouse with me to your house, I think, and could we talk? I think you would say, yes, let's talk. But if that same person said, let me come to your church and preach about what I believe about marriage, I think you'd say, no, you can't do that in our church. This is a different space, and appropriately so. And the same thing with your college. My guess is in your university, you would not say to a student, unless you agree with us totally on what the Bible teaches about human sexuality, you cannot come to our university. I don't think you would say that, because if they have doubts, but they're a sincere Christian, you want them to come and struggle and to help them struggle with it. But you'd still say, the fact that you're here doesn't mean you can live that lifestyle. But you can come here and struggle, right? But that's different than what you do with church, and it's different what you do in your family. Now we're talking about politics. It's, again, a different arena. And partly it's different because you and I don't control it. I mean, we control it a tiny bit. But there are a lot of other people who get to say what is going to happen in our society politically. And in part, it's because there are a lot of them, and we are the moral minority. It's part because there's a constitution, and it gets interpreted certain ways, and we know it has religious freedom in it, but it may get interpreted in a way we don't think is right, and we can argue about that, but at the end of the day, people are gonna, you know, determine it the way they do. So politics is not an arena in which we control ourselves, and it's one which has to somehow do justice, whatever that means, to everybody, despite their deep differences about so many things, right? So if you're a representative, you can say to half your, three quarters of your constituents, you guys are all wrong, I'm just going to do something else. But that's not a very good representative. Somehow you have to make sure that they themselves are protected, but you don't want to encourage them to do wrong, but you want to protect them even though they're going down the wrong path, right? So you can't stop them from wanting to gamble, but you say, but you're going to keep your gambling outside of these areas because that would be so damaging to families or whatever. And as a politician, you just do that. But if, boy, as a church member, you can just say, hey, you're out of here unless you follow what we are sure the Bible teaches. So it's a different arena. But they're not totally distinguished because we live as Christians in all of them. And we want to help influence all of them to be as right as they can be. But it's really hard when a lot of people want to go in the wrong, what we're sure is the wrong direction. And they are determined to go in the wrong direction. Then what do we do about that? That's kind of what we're faced with, I think. So what I thought I would might find most helpful would be to think about this kind of problem, which is that, you know, the Fairness for All strategy is for religious believers who don't believe in the gay cause. We're not against gay people, but we don't believe in their cause and their definitions. To say, we think it's appropriate for the law to protect you in your legitimate actions, but the law has to protect us in our legitimate beliefs. And we're going to come to you and say, let's work out together what those are, because if we don't do that, one of these days you're going to tell us to stop doing the things we believe are right. And we don't want that to happen. We need to protect ourselves. We look to the courts. We're going to keep doing that. If Congress would pass the First Amendment Defense Act, that would be helpful, but doesn't even talk about a lot of these things. So we want another strategy, and we want one that protects you legitimately, but it's got to protect us legitimately. Are you willing to talk? And that's what we've been doing. Are you willing to talk? And if that's the case, then you're going to have to give up some of your absolutism, and we may have to agree to some things that, you know, if it was a different world, we wouldn't agree to. If it was a different world, I would say let's not put all these things in the civil rights law, because that's just a heavy-duty federal government getting in our faces. But sometimes the federal government has to, because people do the wrong thing. We know that about race for certain, and about religion. You may know that for a long time, New York firms wouldn't even hire Jews and Catholics, not only African Americans. Ivy League colleges didn't admit Jews for a long time. The law had to come in and say, that's wrong. You have no reason for that prejudice, so we're going to do things differently. Sometimes law has to come in. And so in our society, a lot of people are saying, hey, we're gay. We are discriminated against. We need protections. We're looking for it. And we say, okay, where it's actual wrongful discrimination, we are happy to protect you. But you can't use that as an excuse for keeping us from living a biblical lifestyle. So that's what Fairness for All is, to say, let's just go ahead and do this. But it's a difficult thing to try, because we don't know about the politics and what's going to be successful and all that. But it's difficult for, let's call it an ontological reason. And I had a good discussion over the years, but then also this morning with Dr. Piper. We kind of talked about some of this stuff and after last night, and he reminded me of this. And so I thought maybe we could focus just a little bit on it, the ontological issue. You know what ontology is? Yeah, it's kind of like the basic, you know, what is reality really? And so if the law, federal civil rights law, protected against sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination, made those protected classes, doesn't that mean that we are saying that those things are just like race? It's just what somebody is, and therefore you have no legitimate grounds on which to not treat those people the way they want to be treated. And I think we would say, wait a second, it's not like race, because the Bible actually says, don't go down that path, whatever your inclinations are, right? And so we don't want to just say it's like race, because race is just something somebody is. But sexual orientation, sexual behavior is something people choose to do. And everybody knows that in some sense, because we know there are celibate people. And how can there be celibate people if having a sexual orientation means you have to engage in that kind of sexual conduct? Then you couldn't be celibate, because if you're heterosexual, you'd have to get into heterosexual relationships. And if you're celibate, you don't do that. So we know there's a distinction. And we think the Bible says what the distinction is. So isn't it bad, wrong, to put into federal law language that says sexual orientation, gender identity is like race? It's also offensive to African Americans. And so it'd be wrong to do in many grounds. So that's what I thought we could talk about a little bit, and then whatever other question you come up with. That's an easy one. No, that's a hard one. But I think we have to do it. So, one place to start is just to say, I said this last night a little bit, is we would like the law to tell us, to only reflect what the truth is about things. But our problem in our society is that we have such deep disagreements about what the truth is, and so, in fact, our law already protects a lot of things that we know are untrue. Our law, for example, does not believe that an unborn child is a human being. That's why you can abort unborn babies, right? Because our law doesn't think that a baby is an unborn human being. Our law doesn't believe the God of the Old Testament and New Testament is a real, living force that we ought to obey. That's not what our law believes. Our law doesn't believe biblical marriage, either on the side of same-sex marriage or on the side of easy divorce. Our law just does not teach people biblical marriage. Our law doesn't acknowledge, generally speaking, that addiction is more than just a chemical, physical thing. It can have a spiritual dimension, and we all know it does. And people can actually be cured from addiction. We know that. But the law doesn't know that. And our law thinks that religion's an optional feature of life. But we know that's not true. We know you obey God or you obey some other God. We know all of us do those things, right? We know that religion's part of a dimension of life, but our law doesn't think that. Our law says, hey, that's religious, that's secular. That's actually not right. But that's what our law says. But our law also says you can believe these other things and you can live them out in our society. In our society, you can be sure that addiction can be cured, that it has a spiritual dimension, and you can have an organization, say Teen Challenge, that does that. And it's not illegal. Even though all these other people say what they do is crazy and wrong and so on. But our law protects that. Our law protects your institutions to say that there's one true God, and it's not Allah, and it's not the Enlightenment. Right? But you can say that and teach that to people, and they're going to shape their life by it. So the law doesn't acknowledge it, but it acknowledges your freedom to believe that. And the same thing with marriage. In many ways, the law still protects your ability to say, I believe marriage between a man and a woman. It ought to be lifetime. Easy divorce is a mistake. And in our institution, we're not going to live with the law's agnosticism about marriage. We're going to live in a different way. And we're going to fire you if you engage in a same-sex marriage. You can do that. So our law gives us room. So it's possible for the law to be mistaken about things and still protect our ability to live by the truth. And it does that at the moment. Still, it'd be better for the law to have all the right things in it. But one of the problems is that you and I aren't making the law, and our culture wants the law to say other things about same-sex marriage, homosexuality, gender identity. And I would like to argue against that and live against that and continue to do that and have the freedom to do that, whatever happens to the law. So Fairness for All is an effort to say, let's agree that we so deeply disagree, and let's put into the law something that we don't entirely agree with, but the way it's written in is one that gives us the freedom to live by our convictions and keep arguing to you that what you believe is not right, and we ought to come to a biblical view. Okay? That's what we're trying to do. Now, I want to, if you'll be patient with me just for a minute, in dealing with these things, I hope you have felt very uncomfortable when Fairness for All has been described to you, or it seems to have been described to you, as we'll protect in the law sexual orientation, gender identity, and we'll protect religious freedom. Don't worry about everything. We'll just protect both of those. Because that's not, that's kind of meaningless. We would like to do that, but the question is, can you actually do that? And that comes down to actual details. Right? And I think one of our problems with not doing something like Fairness for All, which is to actually put into federal law all these things, is that we're left with two principles. One is equality of people despite their sexual orientation, gender identity, and the other is religious freedom. And the law doesn't say, what do we do when these things interact with each other? And what the law ought to say when they interact depends a lot on what the different arena is and what the different thing is we're talking about. It's different if it's a church or McDonald's, right? So a church, I think, ought to be able to fire a staff person if they are in a same-sex marriage. But should McDonald's be allowed to fire them because they're in the same-sex marriage? And if so, why? Well, those are two different things, I think. So, is one of them should be protected, and the other one we should say, no, we can't do that. So, in federal civil rights law, I have discovered as part of all these discussions, these things are dealt with very complexly. In other words, federal civil rights law doesn't just say, we're going to protect all these kinds of people, and then, oh, by the way, we'll protect some religion. But actually, it is a very long document that goes through a lot of different domains of life, like housing and employment, and do you get federal dollars or not, and is it public accommodation, and is it jury duty, and so on, and then says, in this area, something's legitimate, and this area, it's not. And on top of that, the law does not treat its protected classes the same. Race is treated differently than sex and religion, for example, in federal law. So, on the handout, look at the nifty chart at the bottom. Maybe you won't think it's nifty. A law student helped me with this. She read through all the federal civil rights law. Excuse me. I asked her to look at these different domains and then say what's protected in these different areas and are there exceptions. And without going through this in detail, if you just look under the protected class, you'll see that some classes are protected more than others. And if you look at the right-hand column, you'll see that in some areas there are a lot of exclusions or exemptions, and in other areas not so many. All right, so just kind of take that picture in your mind. If you're a lawyer, you'd need to know all the details, but I don't think you need to. But just that federal law treats all these things quite distinctly. So under disabilities law, for example, there are a lot of things churches can get away with that they can't if it's employment law. Because the law just says disability is different than employment, and so we're going to treat it differently in the law, even though disabilities are protected class. Okay? So let me then think with you about the middle section of the page. There's more detail than you want, but I want you to think about it because this is what the actual discussions about fairness for all are all about, is detail. Well, let me start at the top. Back in 1964, after our experience of slavery and Jim Crow segregation and all that, and the civil rights movement, and the federal government finally said, we fought the Civil War, we've done X, Y, and Z, there's still racial discrimination here, we have to pass federal law to protect people. That was the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And at the time, Congress said, we're not only going to protect people against racial, national origin, and ethnic discrimination, but also against sex discrimination and religious discrimination. So those are the big categories in 1964. And one of those was religion. So let's talk a little bit about religion and employment. So the government has, Congress was deciding, we have to protect people against racial, sex, religious, and so on, discrimination in employment. And that's, we think that's what the Constitution requires. We know the Constitution says the government has to protect the free exercise of religion. That's the First Amendment. And what would that mean in the case of employment? Well, that you as a person can't be discriminated against in employment based on your religion, right? That the law firm in New York City can't say, sorry, you're Jewish, we don't hire Jews. So no religious discrimination. But Congress said the law also needs to protect this other part of religious exercise, what people do in religious organizations, which is different than from a secular employer. What do we do about religious employers? Because if we say to them, you can't discriminate based on religion, then how can they remain a religious employer? I mean, does that make sense to all of you? Because Wesleyan institutions hire based on religion. I remember walking the halls of Congress and talking about this with a staff person from a Republican senator's office who said, I like all the things you're proposing except for that religious discrimination employment. That can't be right. And I said, well, how many Democrats do you hire for your office? And she said, well, if we hired a bunch of Democrats, we couldn't run a Republican office. And I said, yeah, exactly. So how can a Wesleyan university be a Wesleyan university if it has to hire without regard to religion? So law said, okay, well, we have something different here than a secular employee. We've got to protect them both. So this is, therefore, what the Civil Rights Act did was, first of all, right in the middle of the page, says that any large enough employer, that's 15 or more people, cannot discriminate on the basis of religion when they hire and fire and so on. Yeah?
Just the one clarification, says race, color, religion, sex.
Yeah.
Sex, from a biological perspective, is male, female.
Yeah. That's what the law says at the moment.
Okay. And but then you have in...
I put in parentheses sexual orientation and gender identity.
Which so the
it's something different than sex. And we want to say that for sure. And we don't want the courts, which are trying to do this, to say sex is the same as these other things. And if the law protects against sex discrimination, then it also applies to the other things. We say, no, that's not right. That's why you have to act legislatively and keep that from happening. Yeah. So at the moment, what the law says is no discrimination based on various things, including religion, by employers that have at least 15 employees. That's a federal law. Right. So that looks like if you're an employer, you can't discriminate based on religion, and what about Wesleyan universities? And that's because the law says other things about the same topic, and that's the rest of it. So I put in here definitions and limits. This is the actual language with some irrelevant parts taken out. The term employer means at least 15 employees. So if you're smaller than 15 employees, federal law about employment doesn't even cover you. But under federal law, a small employer can discriminate based on race. That seems kind of odd, but that's the way it is. Secondly, the term religion includes all aspects of religious observance and practice. So it's not just that when an employer can't discriminate based on religion, it's not just that they can't say, we'll keep you out because you're Catholic or Jewish, but they also can't say, well, we'll keep you out because you wear that funny thing on your head, right? There's a recent Supreme Court case about that. And then that's the third thing. This subchapter doesn't apply to religious organizations. So Wesleyan universities are not subject to the ban on no religious discrimination in employment. That's all part of what the federal law says when it says religion is a protected class when it comes to employment. It's treated differently than race, even though it's a protected class, because it's a different thing. And on the floor of the Congress, they had a debate about this. And their original intention was just to say, well, why would we let an employer discriminate against somebody just because of a religion? And some, thank God, smart senators and representatives said, hey, I know some religious colleges. This would kill them. And we're not supposed to kill them. We're supposed to protect their exercise of religion. So we better put in some other language that qualifies religion, even though we don't put it in for race. So it's a protected class, but it's distinctly protected. And that protection's limited to the kind of entity that it is. Does that make sense? So that's all happened. And in 1964, when all that was done, what the Congress did was actually say, if it's a religious organization, then we'll protect its ability to hire based on religion for religious activities. That's what they said in 1964. And would that be a good policy for Wesleyan universities? I think you'd say, great, you're going to protect our theology teacher and chaplain and the person who runs the chapels and maybe the social worker, but not everybody else in our institution. How can we have a religious community? And so in 1972, when Congress revisited the employment non-discrimination, said we're going to tighten this up, make federal enforcement stronger. That's when they started the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission in 1972. And they lowered the threshold for where this applies all the way down to 15 employees. It used to be 25. So they're strengthening the protection against religious discrimination. They said, we made a mistake. We are now going to protect employment choices by religious entities in every position, not just the religious ones. But every position in a religious entity is protected. You can hire based on religion. And it was actually a Democratic senator who said, why are we going to do that? Because the hands of Caesar don't belong in the things of God. That's a really interesting quote, he said, a South Carolina senator, known as a constitutionalist. And everybody said, well, I guess that's right. And why was that right? Well, a case actually went to the Supreme Court called Amos versus Presiding Bishop. And, you know, secular people say this is a crazy protection because why should it make any difference to you if, like, a clerk, a secretary, a janitor is your faith or not? I mean, they're just, you know, can't they sweep the floors just as well? So the case was actually about a janitor in a Mormon health club. All right, so that's not a theology teacher at BYU. That's a janitor in a Mormon health club. And the health club had fired this janitor because he was no longer faithful in his temple worship. And they said, we have a health club. It's kind of all life health, and we want it to be a Mormon environment, and so you're out of here. So that went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court in 1983, I think it was, ruled unanimously for the Mormon Health Club firing the janitor. And why did they do that? They said, just like they had said in Congress, that you can't leave it to the government to decide for a religious organization which positions are important to them. The organization's got to decide what's important. Or as a friend of mine, Seventh-day Adventist from Australia, he said his father used to be the gardener in a Seventh-day Adventist hospital. And in Australia, they've had all these debates too, and in Australia, they don't protect hiring the way we protect it. And in Australia, they kind of say, but you've got to have a religious duty before we'll protect religious hiring. And my Seventh-day Adventist friend said, but his father had more end-of-life conversations with people than the chaplain did. And why is that? They're at the end of their life, they're suffering cancer, whatever. They go walk in the garden for some peace, and they talk to the gardener. So he witnessed to them about the truth of the gospel. And so the hospital said, we have to hire everybody based on faith. Well, so the law lets you do that. Even though religion's a protected class, it treats it differently than race, because it's a religious organization that has to be allowed to follow its principles. All right. So in the Fairness for All discussion, those are the discussions we've been having. Now, gay people, and certainly the activists that you all hear about, want to say that sexual orientation and gender identity are exactly like race. Right? They're just things that people are. And so how can you be against somebody, not hire them, tell them they can't do what they think is right, just because you don't like what they do? That's the way they talk about it. But you and I know that's not ontologically true. It's not biblically true, it's just not true in life. And we know that sexual identity or proclivity or anything and behavior are two separate things. And we know that, if nothing else, because we require heterosexuals who are unmarried to not engage in sexual activity. But how is that possible if sexual orientation and sexual activity are one and the same thing? Then you would be violating somebody's human rights to say to them, you can't engage in whatever sex you want to. But we know biblically and from practice that people all the time say, I'm going to confine my sexual urges to a legitimate marriage, or because I'm a Catholic priest, a good one, not to engage in it at all, even though that's my inclination. So we know these are distinct things. And we know you can be confused about your gender identity. And that doesn't mean that people were not created male and female. So if there's going to be a law that actually is fairness for all, that actually protects religious exercise, then it has to not go along with that part of the gay agenda that wants to say, this is just who I am, it's just like race. Now, the African American community is sure it's just not just like race. So, and why that voice is not stronger, I don't know. But it ought to be strong in this debate. I mean, for one thing, gay people have not been enslaved for hundreds of years, just to say that. And we can joke about being white or black and acting white or black, but that's just not the same thing as sexual orientation and gender identity. Everybody knows that. But I think gay people basically are saying, we want to be protected solidly, just like black people are. And I think that's fair enough. But what is protecting you solidly while also respecting religious exercise? It can't be saying to a Christian organization, you just have to accept whatever somebody says. So in discussing fairness for all, it has been all about how to actually treat these things in the law if they become protected classes. And then we insist that it has to be like the way religion's treated in as a protected class and not the way race is. Race is treated very differently because it's just a characteristic people have, end of story. And you and I as biblical people know it's wrong to discriminate against somebody because of their race. It's just wrong. But activity is different than your characteristic. So even if it's going to be a protected class, it's going to be treated differently. So all the discussions have been about what is the different treatment it ought to be. And our side, the religious freedom side, has said, unless we treat it differently than race, we're out of here, because it's not going to be fairness for all. Right? It's not going to protect religious exercise. And so even if it becomes a protected class, it's not going to be a protected class like race. We're not going to, the law is not going to say, all of you have to just bow down to what somebody waltzes into your office and says, this is who I am, treat me like that. A religious organization will still be able to say, I think you're wrong about that, and we're going to fire you. And the law will say that's perfectly legitimate. And if the law doesn't say that, it's not going to be fairness for all, and we won't support it. And our gay allies in this effort won't support it either. That's what we're all pledged to. So, let me just give you two examples of the discussion. So we're into multiple pages how to define these things. The goal we're working for in the agreement that we have so far is that a religious organization like a Wesleyan University or Teen Challenge or whatever, Catholic Charities, that hires based on religion would not be subject to the sexual orientation, gender identity, non-discrimination protections. Right? So if your organization hires based on religion, then you can just ignore all the stuff about gender identity and sexual orientation. Now, if your organization messes around with this serious business and pretends to hire based on religion, but actually only takes it seriously when a gay person shows up, then you're going to be in legal trouble. But if you do what Wesleyan universities have been doing, which is to think really hard about what does it mean to hire based on Wesleyan identity, what are our practices? Are we consistent with them? Then you will not be subject to the sexual orientation, gender identity. And, you know, it's been interesting talking with these gay advocates. They say, we get that. Your teaching institution, it's got to be consistent. Faith and sexuality and marriage, those are all a consistent pattern. And we wish you all believe the way we do, but we know you don't. And we know the Constitution protects you and will protect you. But if you are an entity like, for example, a lot of Catholic hospitals, which will fire somebody who shows up in a gay marriage, but won't fire you if you're a devout Muslim, and they say, wait a second, you thought the most important thing was your eternal destiny. And now, just because somebody's in a gay marriage, you're going to fire them. That makes no sense to us. Now, in the Fairness for All discussions, we don't think that Catholic hospital should just be subject to the sexual orientation, gender identity, non-discrimination. They ought to still have a defense in court. And that's why we make sure that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act continues to exist as a strong protection. And that Catholic hospital can go to the law and say, we have good religious reasons to keep out the gay married person, but not the Muslim worker. But they'll have to make an argument, which is what they have to do at the moment. So they've got no fewer rights. But if they're consistent, then they would have total protection. Okay? So we're saying sexual orientation, gender identity is not like race. You're not totally protected against racial discrimination. All right, so there's one example. One other example, just a small one. The federal government, as you might know, funds a lot of marriage strengthening programs. And why does it? Do you have any idea why the federal government would fund marriage strengthening programs with all those people in Washington who don't care a whole lot about marriage, in my personal opinion? I mean, some of them do, but it's a pretty loose culture. Why would they fund marriage strengthening programs? Anybody? What happens to children who don't have parents? More likely to end up in prison, poor, do poorly in school. So as part of welfare reform, the federal government started funding marriage strengthening programs and said it's better for kids to have both parents and the parents getting along together and helping each other out in life. So we want to support that. So a lot of welfare money goes to marriage strengthening programs. Now, the Supreme Court came along and said, first of all, we're going to get rid of the federal definition of marriage. Remember that? The Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, said for federal purposes, whatever states do, for federal purposes, marriage is between a man and a woman. That's the end of the story. So, but the Supreme Court came along and said, no, you can't have that law. So what is a marriage strengthening program that gets federal dollars? What's it supposed to do? Can it teach traditional marriage when the government said there's no such thing anymore, right? That marriage is whatever. And then the Supreme Court came along 2 years later, 1 year later, and said, now we're going to make same-sex marriage constitutional across the whole country. Now, if you get federal dollars to teach a marriage strengthening program, what should you be allowed to teach? A lot of people would say you got to teach that all kinds of marriages are exactly the same. I mean, that's what the court said. But actually, the court said it's perfectly legitimate to believe that marriage is just between a man and a woman. You can read it in the Obergefell decision. People have thought this for centuries. It's a legitimate point of view. We ought to protect people's religious exercise. That's all in the opinion. And so what Fairness for All would say is, if the government's going to strengthen, is going to pay for marriage strengthening, it cannot require the organization to teach one kind of marriage or the other. But it can't keep people out based on their sexual orientation. So you get federal dollars to teach about marriage. You can say a marriage is between a man and a woman. And hey, gay couple, if you want to come and sit in our marriage, we'll be happy to teach you what a good marriage is. And if you find that offensive, go find a different program. So that's one way of dealing with the differences we have. So I think, to my mind, that was a good deal. All right, so let me stop there. I could talk longer, even though I'm not a Baptist pastor. Questions? Yep.
First of all, I apologize that this Fairness for All is something that I was not aware of until I came to this conference.
Yeah.
I probably should have been aware of it, and shame on me. So I've not read the statute or anything like that. Questions I have for in the Fairness for All scheme, what are the roles of, for example, doctrinal statements of the supporting religious institutions, policies and procedures of the affiliate religious institutions that are connected with the churches, and then finally, terms and conditions of the actual employment contracts. And I'm trying to piece them all together. This, to your point about, first of all, being serious about this, and then second of all, about being consistent. And I'm trying to think of the various levels. How important under the Fairness for All regime are those various?
Yeah. All right. Great question. You all heard that? Okay. So first of all, there's not a Fairness for All statute yet. So it's ready to get unveiled in within a couple of months. But even before that, the law does require, as I said, religious organizations to hire based on religion. But you can't make things up because you want to keep somebody out. And so, as I did a whole workshop for Indiana Wesleyan about this topic. It is imperative that if your university hasn't thought all of this through and then had consistency between what you say your religious beliefs are and then what your hiring policies are and then what your actual practices are, then you are in legal jeopardy. Okay, so you say, hey, we're Wesleyan, everybody knows that, but you never say that to people who come to be employed. I know our organization talks to a lot of faith-based organizations, and a lot of them are positive that it must be illegal to hire based on religion, because that's what this federal civil rights law, it protects against religious discrimination, right? Everybody knows that. And so I've actually heard some of them say things like this. We know we only want to hire Christian believers because of what we do, but we know we can't ask about that. So we have other questions, like what do you do Sunday mornings, etc. This is the best way to get yourself in big legal trouble, I think. What would be appropriate is for you to say to anybody who wants to get hired, we only hire Christian believers, and this is what we understand by it. And if you can sign this statement and live by this code of conduct, then we're happy to hire you. And that's perfectly legal. But a court may, if somebody asks you, they're going to say, so why did you make that hiring decision? You can say, well, we made that because we have these standards. And we've told everybody. And it's written down. And we practice them. And then you're perfectly safe.
Whether it's they're under the radar screen in a sexual relationship, or maybe something as simple, not so simple, but all of a sudden alcoholism problem, and they're an alcoholic, and the institution hesitates,
found out and they said, well, you're tolerating this or you're tolerating this, so you cannot have this standard in your hiring.
Well, so I've been in numerous discussions because of Fairness for All with employment lawyers, and I'll say this is all very complicated. And there are kind of like two competing things here. The one thing is that the employee ought to have some certainty about what the requirements are, right? And there ought to be some uniformity across. And if not, then you're just being arbitrary. So there ought to be solidity. But entities make mistakes. If it's a Christian organization, they may want to extend some grace, give people a chance to change, and so on. So there can be legitimate religious basis for not immediately firing somebody. So those are kind of warring principles. And, you know, it's kind of difficult with a federal official who may know nothing about religion, or a court that doesn't understand Wesleyanism and so on, trying to decide, was this fair or not? So it's very complicated. So I think probably the general rule that I've heard ADF and others say is that your standards ought to be very clear, and if you extend mercy, you ought to say something about that and who extends it, and then have some consistency, right? So you don't just extend mercy to the employee who happens to be the cousin of the president, but everybody else, you're out of here, buddy. So what would that look like? I don't know if you want to say anything more. Anybody else? So it's difficult, but I think the more certainty there is, the better off, and the more that's connected with your religious basis, the better off you are. So this is long before Fairness for All. This is just federal law that has to do with, you know, religious discrimination.
Yeah.
Say it again.
And documentation.
Yeah. Documentation is really important. Yeah, shows consistency. Of course, it's the first time, it's hard, but you can document why you decided something. The federal law says no religious discrimination except religious organizations can hire and fire based on religion, right? But you're still subject to the no sex discrimination. Well, what does that mean? Well, if your standard is, religious standard, is no sexual activity out of marriage, you can enforce that legally because that comes under your religious principles, even though it has to do with sex. But if your entity only fires women who get pregnant out of wedlock and doesn't care about the men who are making them pregnant, then you're in legal jeopardy. Of course, one's easier to detect than the other one. But you better be serious about this, or else the courts are just say you're just discriminating based on sex and not based on what you said, which is no sexual activity outside of marriage, but you only go after some people. That's not fair. Right? So these laws are forcing religious entities to become more serious about their faith, and that's not all bad. Yeah.
So Civil Rights Act, Religious Freedom,
yeah.
First Amendment, which maybe isn't specific,
yeah,
per se. Why isn't that just enough?
Yeah.
Now, I get the equality,
yeah,
the push for the Equality,
yeah,
Act that wouldn't have the other side.
Yeah.
But why wouldn't we just take,
yeah,
a position that that's enough?
Yeah. It's a great question. And let me come back to the employment example. So before Congress legislated federal laws about employment discrimination, we had the First Amendment that says no religious, you know, the government has to protect free exercise of religion. All right, so now they're going to make laws about employment discrimination, and they're going to say, how can the employer discriminate against somebody who's just exercising their religion? The Constitution says you've got to protect it. And then Congress said, okay, we get that, so we're going to put in not only no race discrimination, but no religious discrimination. And then somebody says, but then that's going to kill the Wesleyan colleges. So somebody had to say, but that thing about no free exercise of religion that we have to protect, that applies not just to individuals, but to institutions. And how does those two things intersect? And so they said, if it's a religious institution, then they can hire based on religion, but if they're a secular one, not. So there's a principle that had to be worked out in practice. And so I think it's better for all of us that it actually is in the civil rights law that you can hire based on religion, and you don't just have the First Amendment that's sitting there, and if you get into trouble, then you can get a good lawyer who will defend you and say, let's make it a constitutional case.
So does this also come down to having a better position if you've got legislation versus the courts interpreting?
We don't know how the courts are going to interpret. Courts are not very good at making very fine distinctions, right? It's kind of a winner or loser, right? Which side wins? And for one thing, there are a million different instances where these things come to bear, this sexual equality and religious freedom. It's, you know, does your church open its door to have a spaghetti supper? Here's a serious actual discussion that's gone on. Your church has a little bookstore and coffee shop that are open Sunday mornings when your church is open. Somebody may wander in and get a coffee. Are you subject then to all the rules that apply to a public accommodation? Well, that seems not right. It's a worship service, it's a church. But in California, at least, there are mega churches that actually have money-making real estate properties, including here is a whole commercial parking lot owned by this church. Now, can the church say, we'll only allow faithful believers to park in our parking lot? Or is that has nothing to do with the church's business? That's not its own parking lot. It's just running a business. So aren't the rules different for that? So there are a thousand different things, and courts can't, their rules never are about those thousand different things. So we can litigate each one of them, or we can say, what is fair? Let's put that all those basic principles into the law with more detail. But if it's not actually fair to protect religion, then all of us involved in the fairness for all discussion on the religious side will say, this is not fairness for all, we will not support it. So in other words, when the gay people and the religious freedom people came together and said, can we find some common ground? It was never whatever we come up with at the end of the day, we'll say, that's good. It's always been, if we are going to put new protected classes in the federal civil rights law, will we also protect all the legitimate interests of religious people and institutions? And so far, I think we have a lot of very positive agreement. Yeah, well, I don't want to predict too much because some things depend on what happens with the courts and Congress. But this spring, we hope there will be bipartisan introduction of the legislation. And then I think everybody, maybe not all of you, but you know, people who do this kind of thing need to look at it really carefully and say, is it actually fair? Or is there something in it that's just not right that needs to be changed? And so, although I'm a very strong proponent of the principle, I listen all the time to the critics of it, because the critics can sometimes help you see if you've missed something. And I don't want to miss something that's going to hurt your witness or my witness. But, of course, we live in a complex society, and it's not going to be perfect. But is it going to be something that really solidly protects our ability to live by our faith, witness to the truth of these things over time? That's what we're aiming for. And the Equality Act, so that's kind of, let's put sexual orientation, gender identity, federal law without religious protections, and even taking away a bunch that exist at the moment. So that has all these Democratic co-sponsors, has a number of Republicans that have signed on already. We just have a new Congress, right? It's just a week old. Nancy Pelosi said this is one of our first agenda items. And I think that would be terrible if the House votes on the Equality Act before Fairness for All gets proposed, because it's going to be very hard for even Democrats. You know, it's all these representatives. They're sitting there saying, okay, I get there's religious organizations, but oh, there are all these gay people who are saying, we got to protect us, And there are a bunch of voters, and there are more of them than you religious people. And if I've given a binary choice, I'm going to go with the rising generation and not with you people. And if they've done that, and then they voted for the Equality Act, and then they get a third alternative, it's going to be hard to kind of climb back and say, oh, we made a mistake. So we're hoping to get the Fairness for All out there before the Equality Act. And I'm hopeful, I don't like President Trump being persecuted, but I'm hopeful that all the energy into investigating the Trump administration and hobbling it and so on will keep the Equality Act off the legislative agenda. That would be kind of unexpected positive thing about persecuting the president, who, by the way, I think is dreadful in many ways, but has done some good things. So my guess is Equality Act is going to go slower than they think. Yeah. Yes?
As universities, we operate not only in the realm of federal law, but also the accrediting agencies.
Yeah.
With NCAA.
Yeah. So NCAA and accrediting agencies are private agencies. So they're not subject to the Constitution in the same way. So it's a little bit different. So it's a little harder to get at them through a federal law. Also, what states do on their own authority, the federal government usually can't directly command, although it can to some extent. So that's also a little complicated. So I think kind of three things are going on. When it comes to the details of what needs to happen, some of that's going to have to be in specific laws. So the Higher Education Act that Congress has been working on now for a couple cycles and the CCCU has been strongly involved in, that has really strong protections to make sure that accrediting agencies respect your religious mission. And there's kind of stronger language. I think that kind of detail is going to have to be there. But the Fairness for All language that's been talked about has some of that in it. And it comes because even though these are private entities, the federal government takes their decisions as its own, right? So there are, for example, federal positions, federal grants, and things like that, that a person or an entity can only get because they're accredited. Well, so the federal government's kind of farmed out its authority to say who's in or out to a private agency. So in Fairness for All and in the Higher Education Act, the federal government would say, but we can only let you have that authority if you respect the Constitution because we're counting on your decision. And if you don't want to respect the Constitution or the Fairness for All Act, then you can't be our accreditor. We won't listen to your decision. So that's kind of the way to get. The other thing is by actually having these discussions together, it's prompted other discussions to see if there is some common ground that could be found. So in the NCAA discussions, there are, I think it's actually called common ground, there have been a lot of discussions that have been prompted by the gay side and the Christian side to say, yeah, we very much disagree, but is there a way that we can still exist together? You know, so maybe we shouldn't say, just because your entity doesn't affirm gay relationships, that doesn't actually mean our students are in danger if they come on your campus, right? Which is what some gay advocates have said. That's crazy. So maybe we can let you keep your policy and we can still play games together. So I'm hopeful if Fairness for All, if it turns out to be positive the way it has been so far, if it's sponsored by bipartisan legislators, and whether or not it passes immediately or not, it will kind of model a way to live together that we don't have at the moment. And that will help in these other discussions. But, you know, if we are not vigilant, then none of this matters. You can have the best laws, but if we don't exercise our religious freedom, teach what's right about these things, then the law doesn't matter. Yeah.
This new legislation,
affect my world at all as a pastor? My understanding is I can decline a marriage as long as I'm under the Wesleyan umbrella.
Yeah.
This seemed to affect
that. No, it won't affect it at all. So everybody concedes marriage by clergy, that's protected. You have to think a little bit about, as ADF and Christian Legal Society and others have been going around teaching, you have to think a little bit about, however, if you don't just do marriages for Wesleyans, or you don't have some standards that you put out there, and then all of a sudden somebody comes along and you say, well, I won't marry you, but you've married all these other kinds of couples. So it's good to have some kind of statement about, you know, Wesleyan principles. Same thing with your facilities, and think about that a little bit. So all that stuff is important. In our very complicated world, this stuff is important to think it through. But we can do that because our law strongly protects religious entities and religious exercise. But then you've got to tell people that I'm doing this because of my faith.
Fairness for All legislation, what does it have to say about federal funding? And then specifically, it could possibly say, you can hire and fire whoever you want, but if you discriminate in this way, we're not going to fund you with any federal grants, you're not going to be eligible for federal financial aid.
Yeah, it's a great question about federal funding. So there are two pieces. One of them is, just like the First Amendment Defense Act, Fairness for All would say that no entity can be excluded from licenses, accreditation, funding, and so on, just because they have a countercultural belief in marriage or sexuality, something like that. So you can't just say, well, you're that kind of discriminatory institution, you're out. That's fine. But it will probably say something like, if in the service you're providing with federal dollars, schools are a little bit unusual case, but let's say it's a homeless shelter. Here's a service you're supposed to provide to everybody who's homeless. And you turn away gay people, you can't do that. The law at the moment says if you run as a religious organization, you run a homeless shelter, you can't turn away people because of their lack of religion, right? So, but, you know, usually federal civil rights law says you take a dollar of our money and that restriction now applies to everything you do. So in Fairness for All, there are two specific provisions. One of them says the sexual orientation, gender identity, non-discrimination requirements would apply only to the program that's funded by federal dollars, period. So everything else you do it the way you think is right. But this one program, you said you're going to serve everybody, you got to serve everybody with your federal dollars. Okay, so it doesn't bleed over into everything else. And the Orthodox Jewish people we've been working with in this whole process, they said, well, you know, some of these blue states, kind of like the way your question went, they're excluding our synagogues from money that's available to everybody else just because we're religious. And has nothing to do with anything else, just because we're religious and we don't, you know, don't do things the way other people do. So there's a very specific provision that says if the government is giving money to entities because it's for historical preservation, or it's to defend you against terrorist attacks, or it's to rebuild after a flood or whatever, then the government may not ask what your faith is or your sexual beliefs or anything else. You're just eligible if you're eligible, period. They can't exclude you. So I think that's really important. So if it's federally funded services towards other people and you're supposed to serve everybody, you got to serve everybody. But then you don't have to serve everybody and everything else you do without federal funds. You can still run your marriages only men and women. And then over here, you're going to serve every homeless person who comes. So I think that's a fair... Well, from the beginning, we're all in D.C. We go to conferences together, we discuss together, and so on and so on. And they decided quite early that there was no prospect of a good decision. And so if that's the case, then if you start talking with the other side, it just kind of encourages you get caught up in something that's negative. And so... because these are really hard, sensitive discussions, we've had to have them be confidential, so we haven't been able to tell all the details to everybody. And so I think one consequence is that ADF and Heritage Foundation, it's partly just a difference of view of you know, the way you deal with these things out in life. But it's partly because when, I don't think this is being ungenerous. If you look out there at the public statements of gay groups, you would say there's no way they would protect religion. Right? I mean, all the things they say are, we got to crush you, you're going to try to put us in the closet, we're not going to allow that, and so on and so on. And so ADF looks at that and says, well, if you're doing deals with them, we just don't believe it can be something that's fair to religion. And because we haven't been able to talk through all the details, all we can say to them is, that's not what we're doing. But they say back, we don't know how you can be doing anything else, so we just disagree. So that's where we are at the moment. Sorry.
Are you saying that ADF and Heritage looked at this issue and said, we don't see any possibility of a good outcome negotiating with the other side, therefore, for purposes of our reputation and our success rate on issues and how we appear before our donor base, then we don't
no.
want to touch this
No, no,
issue?
I would say, they say, so if you're actually going to protect religious exercise and religious organizations, then you have to keep all this stuff out of federal civil rights law. And to say you can put it in civil rights law and adequately protect religion is not true. So they're trying to protect you just like we're trying to protect you, and they just say it's not possible to do that. So that's a difference of view, and it's partly, I think, a difference of, if you got into negotiation, could you really do it? But it's also a kind of ontological difference, right? If something gets into civil rights law, won't it change over time? You know, now they're willing to protect religion. Maybe 10 years down the road, they'll say, hey, that was a big mistake. We shouldn't have let you guys get away with that stuff. And so they're worried that it's going to be, any protection that's put in will disappear over time. So that's kind of a prudential judgment about what reality is. Can we trust other people? How does law change? And so on. So I don't think this is to protect their donor base. I think it's a different view about the way things work. But I think one of my responses to ADF has always been, but you don't control the agenda. You know, just because we don't want to put sexual orientation, gender identity into federal law doesn't mean it's not going to go there, because we don't control the agenda. You can convince me. I have all these discussions with Heritage all the time, and their donor base, some portion of it, agrees that we shouldn't protect gay people, you know, in all these areas. But they don't control even the Republicans in Congress, much less all of Congress.
Do they have their own alternatives?
Well, they've worked on the First Amendment Defense Act, but that has not successfully made it into law. And in the last Congress, like I said, we had a Democratic president, Republican president, House and Senate. And it did not even get a committee hearing. It wasn't even introduced in the House. All our friends are right there, and they know the cataclysm that's coming, and our Republicans would not protect us. And that's just about marriage. It's not about sexual orientation in general and gender identity. So to my mind, I would like to think that's a good strategy, but I just don't see it. And they're hopeful that if we keep working at it, it'll come one of these days. But I just think things are getting more negative. But I think the other thing is, they say, but we can be protected in the courts. And I'm just not convinced of that. So, yeah.
What would your response be to someone who says, if you support FFA, you're compromising biblical principles?
Yeah. Well, so I think the proof will be in the pudding. So biblical principles are true for everybody, but a lot of people don't live by them, right? So what we can ask the law to do is to let us live by them and let us tell other people, we think it's better for you if you live by them, right? But the law can't force people to live by them. And so I think protecting the ability of Christians to live faithfully and protecting other people in their legitimate civil rights is a biblical position. It's not the position we'll have after the second coming, which we'll all just voluntarily do the right thing. But we're not there. And even Jesus said, because of the hardness of your heart, we're going to allow divorce, right? But we're not going to allow just anything be divorce. It's going to have limits. So we're saying, okay, we get it. the law was trying to tell you that same-sex marriage is not a marriage, but you didn't believe it, and you now forced us to change the law. And the law said sodomy is illegal, and that did not stop the gay movement. And so what do we do when people are just determined to go down this other path? And I think then we ought to say, please protect us because we know what's right for us and you, and let us live this way, and let us keep telling you, don't shut us up, as has happened in so many countries. Let us keep telling you. I think that's biblical. All right, we're probably out of time. Oh, we got 1 minute. No? Thank you so much. Will somebody end us in prayer, please? Because these are hard things. I think everybody on the Fairness for All side would, if it takes a bolt of lightning or ADF or somebody to tell us we're wrong, to help us see what's wrong, and then we'll do something else. And if there are better strategies, we ought to find them. And if we can convince our Republicans to do better, let's do that. So we need a lot of wisdom here. And so will somebody pray for that? Who will do it? Amen. Thank you all.